the classification theorem for AF algebras, I thought today I would try and give you some overview of what else you can do in terms of classification, what the necessary invariants are. And also, since this is supposed to be some kind of advanced course, try and give you some idea of recent results in the classification theory of C-star algebras, which show that, in fact, K-theory and traces do not always suffice for classification, and to give you some sense of why that is and where research is going presently. Okay, so the first thing I'd like to do is just remind you of these two definitions. So last time I mentioned this K1 of A. This would be A unital. So K1 of A was this quotient this thing U infinity of A, which you could think of as a nested union of unitaries in MN of A, right? And you would mod out by this U infinity A 0, which was the bit which was equivalent to the unit of the algebra, really just homotopic to the algebra. So on a good day, and indeed on every day when classification seems to hold, this sometimes it's simply the case that this group is the quotient of the unitary group of A by the connected component of the identity. Okay, so I think really for the purposes of this course that's the most useful way to think of it. If this fails to be isomorphic to this, then you're probably in some strange territory already. And the other definition that I had was this P of A, the traceful state space of A. So this is maps tau. This is going to be a positive linear functional such that it doesn't see non-commutativity, if you like. So tau of xy is equal to tau of yx. So you have the space of all of these. Tau A is a compact, matrizable, what is called Choquet simplex. If A is separable. Okay. But the main point is that it's an affine space. You can take convex combinations of traces, get other traces. And when I say compact, we're talking about the weak star topology here on this space. Okay? So we have K0, which we've studied quite a bit. This is, we have K1, which keeps track of the unitaries up to homotopy. And we have this space tau of A. You can think of this as the existence of kind of non-commutative integrals on your algebra, right? Okay, so then I can tell you about what is called the Elliott invariant. Okay, so, and for convenience again, we're going to let A be a unital C-star algebra. Although one has a definition in the non-unital case too. So the Elliott invariant of A is, we'll denote it by this ELL of A. It's a four tuple. It's four pieces of information in it, okay? The first is the K0 group. So, and not just the K0 group, but the K0 group with its attendant pre-order, possibly partial order, and distinguished order unit equal to the K0 class of the unit of the algebra. Okay, so it's K0, its usual structure, K1 of A. This T of A, the tracial state space, and finally there is one other piece, rho of A, and what is rho of A? It's a pairing between the tracial states and the K0 group, okay? So and a little aside here, if P is equivalent to Q, these are projections, for instance, then notice that the tau of P is equal to tau of Q for all tau in the tracial state space. Because, why? Because P is equal to V star V, Q is equal to V V star, right? So you can turn around the V and the V star. It doesn't affect the trace. Okay? And in fact, this extends to K0 classes. So traces are well-defined. They give states, in fact, on the K0 group. And so this rho of A just records how that pairing goes. So it's a map from K0 of A, Cartesian product, the tracial state space, to the reals, and rho of some pair, x, tau, is just equal to tau of x, which is well-defined by this comment here. Okay? So there are these four pieces in the Elliott invariant. Now, I mean, something that I would hope to get to maybe by the end of the day is an explanation for why this seems, you know, quite big, and there are many complicated pieces. It has recently become apparent to us that, in fact, it's sort of because this is something else in disguise. So there is a much cleaner description of this invariant, which, moreover, is a finer invariant in general, and which reduces to this Elliott invariant in all the cases where Elliott's classification conjecture works. Right. So, okay, well, I have to tell you about the question, basically. And so I tried to give examples last day which showed that each of these pieces is necessary. Certainly, we know the K0 group is necessary for distinguishing C-star algebras and the K1 group. In the tracial state space, okay? So all of these pieces are necessary. The question is, to what extent is this invariant sufficient to determine a C-star algebra octastar isomorphism? So. To what extent does this invariant determine C-star algebras up to isomorphism? Okay, so there are some broad restrictions on the class of C-star algebras that you can consider, and I'll try and explain what those are roughly. Okay, so I'll just say it turns out that some broad restrictions are required. So the first of these is norm separability. Norm separability of the C-star algebras you're considering. So, I mean, of course, all these necessary assumptions come about because there are some examples that show them to be necessary. So, for a two, because I don't know how much we know about von Neumann algebras, but let's just say if A is a C-star subalgebra of B of H, such that A is equal to its own bicommutant, that is, the set of all the things which commute with all the things which commute with A, then A is what is called a von Neumann algebra . Okay, and let's go over here now. A if you have a von Neumann algebra, one of the first things that, they're called von Neumann algebra since they were first studied by Murray von Neumann, but one of the first things that was done in connection with these C-star algebras was to classify them into some broad types. Okay? So, such an algebra always admits what is called a dimension function D from the projections of A to R such that it's insensitive to Murray von Neumann equivalence. So when P and Q are equivalent projections, they should agree on this dimension function. And the dimension function of a sum is the sum of the dimension functions if P is orthogonal to Q. Okay? So think of it as a rank function. It's certainly, that's exactly what it is in the case of square matrices or the complex numbers. So every von Neumann algebra has one of these, and you can ask what is the range of this dimension function, and in the case that your von Neumann algebra has a trivial center, so this is what's called a factor, then you can divide the von Neumann algebras into various categories according to what the range of the dimension function is. So I don't want to talk all about the classification of factors, but anyways, exist. So if A has trivial center and the image of all the projections of A is equal to, this should be normalized, so D of 1 should be 1, but anyways, and you have this equality, which surprisingly is possible. I mean, you can somehow have continuous measure of dimension. Then A is called a 2-1 factor. All right, so this the 2-1 factor is kind of the primordial C-star algebra. So there are different ways to build 2-1 factors. One way is to take one of these. When we're studying AF algebras, you can consider inductive limits where at each stage you have a finite dimensional algebra which has only one direct summand, right? So it's just a square matrix algebra, and you can look at this inductive limit. This gives you what is sometimes called a UHF algebra. And if you take that C-star algebra and represent it with respect to its GNS representation corresponding to the unique trace on B of H, and then you take this bicommutant, so you take the image of your algebra in B of H and you take its bicommutant, then you do get a type 2-1 factor. And that one is somewhat special because it's approximated from within by finite dimensional C-star algebra, so it's sometimes called the hyperfinite 2-1 factor. However, it is a fact that the hyperfinite 2-1 factor is not the only 2-1 factor. So why is all of this... so let me just say this, there exists many non-isomorphic two-one factors . They are not norm separable, okay? And they all have the same Elliott invariant. Okay, so the Elliott invariant in the case of a 2-1 factor is K0 is actually the real, and there's no K1 and there's a unique trace. Yeah?
Sure. I missed something on the third line of that word there.
Yes, thank you. To respect sums when they're orthogonal. Yes, sir. Right. So the point is that one has a bunch of examples of non-norm separable C-star algebras, which nevertheless all have the same Hellian invariant. I mean, one way to get, say, a 2-1 factor, which is not the same as the hyperfinite one, is to take the, if you take a non-amenable countable discrete group, and then you form the von Neumann algebra, you take the left regular representation of that group, and then take the enveloping von Neumann algebra of that, then you will get something not isomorphic to the hyperfinite 2-1 factor. Anyway, the point is that certainly if you don't have separability, you're going to have some trouble. So we'll need that. Another thing it turns out we will need is simplicity. Right. So this means no non-trivial closed two-sided ideals. Okay. So for an example of this, actually I can use something similar to what I had last time. Let's form some inductive limits here. So I'm going to take matrices whose entries are continuous functions on the interval, and I'm going to have them go up by powers of 8, but this is not really so important. It just has to be big enough somehow. And then at each stage, I'll define a pair of maps, which will define a pair of inductive limits, C-star algebras. Okay. So we'll say that phi I of F, that's just going to be equal to F 8 times down the diagonal, and gamma I of F, that will be F only 7 times, and then in that last little corner, I will instead take F and I will evaluate it at some chosen point in the interval. So if the XIs are chosen carefully, then the limit, the inductive limit of, let's say it this way, M sub 8 to the I, C01, with the bonding maps, these gamma i's, this inductive limit is simple. Okay? So it has no closed two-sided ideals, which are non-trivial. On the other hand, if you take the inductive limit of this guy, actually, but this limit here, this has exactly the same ideal structure. As C01. So the idea of the closed two-sided ideals in C01 correspond to closed subsets of C01. You look at all the functions which vanish on some fixed closed subset of C01. And it turns out that the inductive limit with respect to this fairly naive bonding map here it really has exactly the same sort of ideal structure. It's actually just a tensor product of C01 with some UHF algebra. Okay? So, but a very small change in the bonding maps, I can go from simple to a huge lattice of ideals. And so, of course, the main point is that they have exactly the same Hellian invariants. So the K0 groups here, remember, K0 is a homotopy invariant. So each one of these algebras here is actually homotopy equivalent to square matrix algebra. And therefore, we know that its K0 group is the same as some AF algebra. It depends only on the matrix sizes. All right? And moreover, at every stage, this is contractible to a point, there's no K1. So K0 and K1 are the same for both of the algebras. And in order to determine that the trace spaces are the same, then you have to do a little bit of work. You have to sit down and actually grind out what the induced maps are So when you have a map from one piece of algebra to the other, it induces a map in the opposite direction on the traceful state spaces. And in the case of this map, it's the identity on the trace spaces, okay? And in the case of the other one, it's almost the identity, except it's like taking a convex combination of the identity with some other very small point mass, okay? Which gets less and less significant as you go out in the inductive sequence. Anyways, so you do get the same. So both limits are the same. Same area invariant. Okay, so we need separability, we need simplicity, and there is one more thing that we know we need, but yes. So what has to happen is that, I mean, you have to have a sequence of points which, given any open subset of the interval, the sequence revisits that open subset infinitely many times. So what this guarantees is that if you start with any non-zero element at any stage, it must be non-zero on some open set, right? And then if you have the sequence of points which revisits that open set infinitely many times, eventually what will happen is that you will wind up evaluating your function at that point, and then the matrix you get further out has the property that it's everywhere non-zero, and that's enough to know that it, as a two-sided ideal, it generates the whole algebra at that later stage, and therefore the algebra is simple.
Is there an example of two algebras both not simple, which are not isomorphic in the same
value? Sure, yeah. Just that much easier.
To make the thing that wasn't the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite easy to build all sorts of examples. Okay, so the last thing that we know we need, but sadly you're not entirely sure why yet, is a property called nuclearity. Equivalently. It's sometimes called amenability. So amenability and nuclearity started out as separate concepts in the literature of C-star algebras, but it was through some deep work, particularly of Uwe Holup, that it was discovered that, in fact, nuclearity and amenability are equivalent concepts. So I won't even bother defining both. All I'm going to do, in fact, is give you one statement, which is equivalent to nuclearity, and the reason I don't want to dwell on it too much is because we don't really understand why it's important other than the fact that it's necessary in order to get. If you don't have nuclearity, then you get extremely dramatic counterexamples to this classification conjecture, I guess. So we say it's nuclear. Yeah. For all finite sets G subset of A and epsilon greater than zero, there exists what are called completely positive maps C and a finite dimensional C star algebra F, such that the following diagram commutes. The idea simply is that the identity map on the C-star algebra can be factored through this finite dimensional C-star algebra. Okay, so these completely positive maps, I haven't told you exactly what that means yet, but at any rate, one goes from A to the finite dimensional algebra, the other back up into A. And what happens is that this commutes up to epsilon on the finite set G, right? So it doesn't commute, it only commutes approximately, and in fact it only commutes approximately on that finite set G. Completely positive maps, these are just linear maps which preserve positivity, Okay, so they needn't be multiplicative, really. They're not going to be multiplicative in general. But they preserve positivity of elements in the C-star algebra. Not only that, what completely positive means is that when you amplify them, so if you look, these are initially maps from A, out of A, you can amplify them so that they're maps on M2 of A or M3 of A, just by applying the map to each coordinate in a matrix algebra over A. And those amplified maps should still also preserve positivity. Okay, so that's what completely positive means. And this property is sometimes called the completely positive approximation property. I mean, it was Kirchberg who showed that this really implied nuclearity. Anyway, so we seem to need this property. It's very clear why we need it in the case of purely infinite C-star algebras. There's a very nice theorem of Kirchberg which uses it as a crucial hypothesis, but in the case of stably finite C-star algebras, it's still slightly mysterious. Okay, so then now we've said enough that we can put forth a... Oh, I have to say one more thing. I have to tell you what a morphism is between Elliott invariants. So let's let A be unital C-star algebras. A morphism. And I'll write it this way, theta, Elliott invariant of A to Elliott invariant of B, is a triple so theta will be theta 0, theta 1, theta sub t, such that, all right, and this picture suggests the Elliott invariant is a functor, okay, but in fact it's neither covariant nor contravariant. It has covariant and contravariant pieces, so the direction of this arrow shouldn't be taken to mean covariant. So what are the pieces? Well, phi 0, that's a covariant piece. It goes from k0 of A to k0 of B, is a positive order unit preserving group homomorphism. As you might expect, say a map between C-star algebras induces precisely this kind of map between K0 groups. There's not a lot to be said about the map between K1 of A and K1 of B. It's just a group homomorphism. And and then the last piece is a map between the trace state space of B and the trace state space of A. Right? So this is the contravariant piece. It goes in the other direction. And this is a continuous affine map such that, and remember there's this final piece to the Elliott invariant, which is this pairing between K0 and traces, and that comes into the question of what an allowable morphism is in the following way. You have to have that X, so row A of X in the image of some trace tau and tau of B, that should be equal to rho B of theta 0 of X paired with tau. Okay. So, I mean, the short way to say this simply is that these maps at the level of K0 and traces are just compatible with this pairing that you have between K0 and traces in each case. So that's a morphism. And an isomorphism is when all of these are, this is an isomorphism, isomorphism, isomorphism. Then the conjecture of Elliott from the early 1990s is this, so let A, B, B. So what do we want? We know that we need them to be simple, unital separable, amenable C-star algebras. So the conjecture is that if there exists an isomorphism at the level of Elliott invariants, then there exists a star isomorphism, a C, from A to B, such that C induces the original morphism at the level of the invariant. Okay, so not only are the algebras isomorphic, but the isomorphism lifts. Right. So a comment aimed maybe at people who are familiar a little bit with von Neumann algebras and the classification there. This list of four assumptions is somehow very natural if you know what the classification of von Neumann algebra says. So Kahn got the Fields Memo for proving that certain factors were classified up to isomorphism. A factor is naturally, if you like, kind of like simple. It has a trivial center, and it's automatically unital. The conditions for Kahn's classification are, moreover, that this factor have a separable predual and be what is called injective. So norm separability and amenability are the natural conditions on a C-star algebra, which guarantee that the weak closures of all its GNS representations have separable predual and are injective. Okay, so this is the very natural analogs of the assumptions required in order to classify factors. So what I want to say about now is, I want to mention some of the important cases where this is known to hold. So one really nice result, of course, is this. So when does this hold? So one is the case of called Kirchberg algebras. Okay? So what are these? I will assume throughout that the algebras I'm talking about are simple, unital, separable, amenable. Okay? The additional assumption for Kirchberg algebras is that they are purely infinite and satisfy what's called a universal coefficient theorem. UCT. Okay, so first of all, what does purely infinite mean? Well, one way to say it in this setting is purely infinite. For all x not equal to 0 in A, there exists AB in A such that AXB is equal to the unit of the algebra. Okay? This is one definition. Another way to say it is that every hereditary subalgebra of the given C-star algebra contains an infinite projection. All right? This is the origin of the terminology. Purely infinite. So all the projections are infinite in a strong sense. I don't want to say too much about this universal coefficient theorem. I'll mention it again in a second. So theorem due independently to Kirchberg and Phillips is that conjecture holds for Kirchberg algebras so this is quite a large class of C-star algebras. In fact, what gets proved in this theorem is something slightly more general, and that is that if you forget about this second technical condition here, this universal coefficient theorem, what they prove is that these algebras are isomorphic when they are KK equivalent. So this is a notion of, so there's a bivariant version of K-theory, which we have no time to talk about in this course, but it's a very powerful theory, and in fact, the main result of Kirchberg and Phillips should properly be stated in terms of KK theory. Okay, so the two of these Kirchberg algebras without the universal coefficient theorem are isomorphic as and only if they're KK equivalent, but if you have this universal coefficient theorem, then you can get from this bivariant K theory equivalence down to, you can show that that's synonymous with isomorphism of the usual K groups that we have been talking about in this course. So that's the reason for this assumption here. So for example, what's an example of a purely infinite algebra? I guess you can have isometries S1 to Sn such that Si star Si equals 1, and also the sum from I equals 1 to n of Si star is equal to 1. Okay? So it's just n isometries in Hilbert space with orthogonal ranges. Right? So the C star algebra is a Kirchberg algebra. Called O-N. It doesn't depend on the isometries that you choose here, okay? You always get the same thing. And here you have that K0 of O-N is Z mod N minus 1 Z. K1 of O-N is 0. Okay, so there's an example of some Kirchberg algebras. Oh, one other thing. Now, this invariant, of course, has several pieces, but in the case of purely infinite C-star algebras, much of this invariant kind of vanishes. So the trace of state space, in particular, is empty for these C-star algebras. There's no non-trivial trace on these, so that's gone. And with it, this little row of everything is gone, so those disappear. And also, it turns out that the order structure on K0 of A is irrelevant. In fact, any two non-zero projections have the property that the class of P is less equal than the class of Q. So all that you have left, right, so mention this, so the invariant reduces to K0 of A, the class of the unit of A, K0 and K1 of A. So that's quite a nice theorem. You have real cohomological rigidity. Okay, so that's one very nice result. The next one related more closely to the AF algebras are AT algebras. Okay, so A here should be, again, with the standing assumption that all the algebras I'm talking about have to be simple, unital, separable, amenable. So that's what I want for A. And what is AI? Well, it is the sum, I'll say, from J equals 1 to M sub I of matrices, some size, whose entries are continuous functions on the circle. Okay? So the AT stands for approximately circle algebras. Okay? So this is the kind of algebra we want. You can get quite a wide variety of K-theory coming out of these, so I'll say more about that in a second. Let me first just state the theorem. And this, I guess, is due to Elliott in the real rank zero case, and I believe to Klaus Thomson. Is that right? George is there. So the theorem is that unital simple AT algebras are classified, and in the real rank zero case, this is your theorem, and then in the real rank one case, I believe it's a theorem of Clausthausen, yeah? Okay. Even in the real rank one case, yeah?
Well, look, if real rank one is the right rule, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, maybe, yeah. I don't know. Sorry about that, pal. Okay. Right, okay. All right, well, so here's there's some long paper in the memoirs of the French Math Society, but this is somewhat more general, I guess. Is that right? So with due to Eliot, with especially readable proof due to others. The theorem is unital simple AT algebras satisfy the conjecture. One last thing about this is that and this is very much a non-trivial thing to show, is that this class of C-star algebras covered for the first time some very natural examples. So, a rotation algebra, a theta, is generated by two unitaries. U and V, such that U V equals E to the 2 pi I theta V U. So they don't quite commute. They commute except for this twisting by some number of modulus 1. So if theta is not rational, then a theta is a simple AT algebra. And this is due to Eliot and Evans. This kind of algebra, these rotation algebras, this is a fundamental sort of example in non-commutative geometry. And so that was what was particularly exciting about this classification together with this result, is that it shows that these inductive limits, you know, which a priori, I mean, it's nice that they're classified, but why them particularly? It shows that that many natural C-star algebras have the structure of an inductive limit of certain tractable building blocks. It's later been shown by Chris Phillips that generalizations of these higher non-commutative tori, where you have n different unitaries satisfying various skew relations like this, are also always AT algebras whenever they are simple. And something that Chris will talk about, I believe, that we're not going to talk about in this class, is the fact that this, so here's C of T, this C-star algebra that we're talking about here, this irrational rotation algebra, is called the irrational rotation algebra because it really comes from taking a circle and rotating it by some irrational angle, and then taking what is called the cross product. So if you rotate the circle by some irrational angle, this gives you an automorphism of the algebra of continuous functions on the circle, and you can form what is called the cross product C-star algebra of this commutative C-star algebra with the action of that automorphism. And the idea is that you simply find a bigger C-star algebra in which the automorphism of C of, in which C of T sits, and moreover there's a unitary in there which implements the automorphism. Okay? So these are examples of C-star algebras coming from classical dynamics, and that's another reason why this classification theorem is particularly important, together with this result. It shows you that, for the first time, the C-star algebras arising from classical dynamics are amenable to classification. It's a very recent result that, in fact, not all of them are amenable to classification. That's another story. Okay, so that's AT algebras. Did that say what? Swiss? Oh, okay. But he had some long paper where he classifies some subhomogeneous limits in the memoirs of the French Math Society, but I presume that came after this.
Well, okay,
right. Okay. Which covers this, but it was later. All right. Well, one other thing I wanted to mention is that here, any instance of the Elliott invariant can arise if k0, k1 are torsion free. Right? So you have this theorem which says, of course, that if these two things have the same invariant, then they're isomorphic. Moreover, isomorphisms at the level of the invariant lift. But to really make it a complete theorem, you would like to know what the range of the invariant is for your particular class of C-star algebras. And there's also a complete answer for that. And the answer is that any group, you know, any dimension group can occur for K0, any countable group can occur for K1, and any trace space and pairing can occur between K0 and K1, and these can all be varied independently. So this is a theorem of Jesper-Villardson, but says that the invariant is exhausted subject to the only obvious restrictions, the torsion-freeness of the K-theory. Right. Huh? Yeah, right. So after the break, I think I will start to talk a little bit more about what this guy Villardson did and some very interesting C-star algebras that he introduced. Okay? Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so. So, what I'd like to talk about now is, or are, rather, the origins of some techniques of a fellow named Jesper Willardson, which have come to be quite important in classification. So, I guess he was originally motivated by the following question posed by Bruce Blackadar. And that is the following, let A be a unital, simple C star algebra with a trace. It has to have a trace. Suppose that P and Q are projections in A such that tau of P is strictly less than tau of Q for all traces tau. And the question is, does it follow that P is dominated by Q for the Murray von Neumann equivalence relation? That is P equivalent to a subprojection of Q? Right. Certainly, if you have this relation here, and it's definitely true that the tau of P is less equal to tau of Q for every trace. The reason that we have strict inequality here is that, well, I mean, because it simply doesn't work if you have just inequality with possible equality. Right? That's well known. However, it was also known at the time that in a unital simple AF algebra, this was always true. Right? So in a certain sense, you're saying that the order structure on the K0 group is determined by traces. So the answer from Willardson is no. Okay. So in order to try to explain Willardson's construction, what we have to do is revisit the notion of projections in matrices over a commutative C star algebra. Willardson's techniques relied on viewing projections in matrices over a commutative C-star algebra as vector bundles. All right, so definition there. So a vector bundle is a triple E P. D, where E, B are topological spaces, P from E to B continuous, P inverse of any little b is actually isomorphic to n-dimensional complex vector space, some fixed n, and we have what is called local triviality. So that's the following condition. for all points in B, this is sometimes called the base space, all right? So for all points in the base space, there exists some open neighborhood of B and a continuous map, we'll say U, not U, we'll call it T sub B, And the map goes from the Cartesian product of this open neighborhood UB with complex n-dimensional vector space to the inverse image of this open set U. And this satisfies two properties. The first is that if you look at the fiber over B, that's contained in the fiber over B, B prime, for all B prime, and here. And this map, when it's restricted to one of these fibers, is actually an isomorphism, a linear isomorphism. So what is the idea? I mean, this is just a formal definition, but the idea is this. You have some base space, and to each point in the base space, you attach a copy of n-dimensional complex vector space, right? And then you glue these copies of n-dimensional complex vector space together according to some topology, all right? Where their topology is given by this E, this total space. So B is the base space. You think of B as maybe the line, and then think of E as the line with attached to each point some vector space, okay? And this rule, local triviality, just says that locally, this whole topological structure just looks like the Cartesian product of some neighborhood with n-dimensional complex vector space, all right? So I mean, like the Möbius strip, this is an example of a vector bundle. A real vector bundle, I guess. Just because somehow you need to know something about characteristic classes of vector bundles in order to. Yes, but it would somehow be less elementary than this, I think. I mean, a natural source of vector bundles, as George says, is just projections in a matrix algebra over some computative C-star algebra. So if P in MN C of X is a projection, then P, I'll just say it corresponds to a vector bundle over X over X. How does the correspondence go? Well, at each point of X, right, you can evaluate this projection P. So you just have a projection in MN, and you just look at the range of that projection. And that's some, if X is connected, then P will have some constant rank, say K. Right, and then at every point of X, the range of P is some copy of K-dimensional complex vector space, which varies smoothly, if you like, as you pass over X. Right? So it's the range of PX as X varies. Okay, so here X is the base space, and the total space is the collection of all these ranges. So what Villison was interested in doing was answering this question, and what this really meant, what does this mean? P is not less equal to Q. It means that, or certainly one thing that would imply it, is that if you had this non-positive, right? And if this holds, then this difference has to be positive in K0. So what Villison was going to try to do was to construct some elements in K0, first of all, of just some matrix algebra over a commutative algebra, with the property that they were not positive elements in K0, but some multiple of them was positive. So if you remember this, when I spoke about the K0 group of an AF algebra, I mentioned this property could have called weak unperforation, the property that if n times some element is positive, the original element has to be positive. Okay? So what he was going to show was that this property could fail in a unital simple C star algebra, and that would be enough to answer this question negatively. Anyway, so how did he go about doing this?
Well, this is a lemma, so let me just see. The Euler class of a vector bundle omega over x is, well, we write it this way, E of W. What it's just some element of cohomology, integral cohomology of the space X, and it lives in the 2 times dimension of omega, its cohomology group, where dimension of omega, this is the fiber dimension, the size of these vector spaces that you're attaching at every point of X, right? Has some nice properties. And what Villadsen proved is this, the following little lemma. Yes? So let, well, let me just say one property first. It has the property that if you take the Euler class of some sum of vector bundles, then this is equal to the product of the Euler classes, where this sum that I'm talking about here is really a fiber-wise direct sum. Okay, so at each point of X, you have a vector space corresponding to each one of these vector bundles, and you just take the direct sum of it. So it's a nice way to take sums of vector bundles. And the Euler class, whatever it is, just some element of cohomology, has this nice property that when you want to take the Euler class of some sum of vector bundles, then it's just a product. This is the cup product in cohomology. Okay, so Villadsen's little lemma was the following. One more thing. You let theta sub L denote the trivial vector bundle which is just the Cartesian product of your space X with L-dimensional complex vector space. All right. So the idea of the trivial vector bundle is that you're not exploiting any of the potentially strange topology of X. Okay. You're not having the vector bundle sort of, you're not having these spaces twist as they pass over X. It's just trivial. And note that that the Euler class of any trivial vector bundle is 0. Okay? So the dilemma of Villadsen, which really, I mean, there's no limit to the ways in which this has been modified since then to answer all sorts of old questions about C-star algebras. And it was this fundamental lemma. He said that if omega 1 through omega n are one-dimensional vector bundles, and the product of their Euler classes is not equal to 0, then if you look at the following K-theory class, so remember, these vector bundles, right, I mean, I can think of them, well, it turns out you need a theorem for this, but anyways, you can think of them as projections in here, right? So through this correspondence between vector bundles and projections, you could think of their K0 class, the K0 class of some projection, and what he showed was that this difference of K0 classes, this sum of these line bundles minus some trivial bundle, that's not positive if L is strictly less than N. Okay? So all his lemma was a little technical tool for proving that certain differences of K0 classes were not positive in matrices over some commutative C-star algebra. However, and this is a much more general theorem, so this is not really part of the lemma, but nevertheless it's true. However, dimension of X times this difference not even bother saying it that way. I could say it even more simply. However, tau of that class is strictly greater than tau of the class of the L-dimensional vector bundle for all tau in the tracial state space of MN C of X. Okay, so here in MN C of X is an example of the kind of phenomenon Phillotson wanted to find in a unital simple C-star algebra. He wanted to find two projections. So this statement says precisely, or says at least, that this projection is not Murray von Neumann equivalent to a subprojection of this guy. All right? So. Well, I mean, I guess it could be, you know, it could be bigger.
Yeah,
that's true. You can drop it. But I mean, the only. But if, well, no, actually, you can't in order for this to be true over here. Yeah, so that's what you want. I mean, this is the surprising case. The other case is trivial. I mean, if so it's supposed to be there in light of the. You want this conclusion here. You want an instance in this MNC of X of the kind of phenomenon you're looking for in a unital simple algebra, namely one projection which is not Murray von Neumann equivalent to a subprojection of some other one, and yet for which this strict inequality at the level of traces holds. The reason this inequality holds, roughly speaking, is that because these are of constant rank, I mean, the trace depends only on the rank. The projection. So there really are no interesting states on the K0 group of a commutative C-star algebra coming from traces as long as X is connected. There's only one state you can get on K0, and that's the one which returns the dimension of the projection, normalized. Okay? So that's why this holds. It's not a hard thing to prove at all. Okay. Well, I mean, I need it over here. I realize it's not really. It's a little out of place over there. I could put it over there. Oh, God, let's not be petty. Well, it makes perfect sense. It's a true state. It does. It does. We can put that. Okay. So here's the phenomenon that Villison had in a commutative C-star algebra. He wanted to put this all together and find this phenomenon in a unital simple C-star algebra. So he needed some cleverness for that. And I'm not sure how much detail of this I will be able to accurately convey to you, but I'll give you the construction. So here's step one on the way to this simple case. That's what A1, I believe he took it to be M4 C of S2 cross S2 for a specific space. The reason that he chose this space is the following. Over S2, you have a projection called the Bach projection. Okay, so it's a projection in M2 of C of S2, which as a vector bundle does not correspond to a trivial vector bundle. Okay, and in fact, you have a Bach projection over this copy of S2, and you have another one over this copy of S2, and you can take the sum of them. So those are both one-dimensional vector bundles here, and you can add them up. Okay, and it's just, you choose this space precisely because both of those projections have non-zero Euler class, so these individual little things are not zero, but moreover, because of the structure of the cohomology of that space, S2 class S2, you know in fact that the cup product of those two things is also not zero. These are the two sort of independent generators of H2 here. So take say pi 1 or pi I from S2 cross S2 S2 coordinate projections and let Xi in M2 S2 be a vector bundle. All you really need, in fact, is that it's a vector bundle with Euler class of Xi not equal to zero. That's the only requirement. And, I mean, I won't explain why that's true. It is true. Certainly these things exist in M2 of S2. We'll put Xi 1 equal to so a construction that you can always perform with vector bundles is that you can pull them back. So if you have a continuous map from one space to another and a vector bundle here, it pulls back to a vector bundle naturally over here. So I'll denote by Xi1 and Xi2 these two pullbacks. Okay, then what do you do? So, it's simply a fact that we'll accept is that the product of these two guys, these two Euler classes, is not zero. So, so the sum of them minus a one-dimensional trivial vector bundle, this is not in positive part of K0, but as I pointed out, over here, it certainly has the property the trace of this is strictly bigger than the trace of this for any trace. Now, let's let A2, let's let that be M8. And what will it be? It'll be the continuous functions on S2 cross S2. And now we are going to double that space, if you like. So we double the size of the matrices, and we took the Cartesian square of the space we started with. And let's let gamma 1, 2, let's let these be the coordinate projections now. Okay. Yes, I do. Thank you. then you want to define a map, phi, C1 from A1 to A2, and the structure of the map is as follows. C1 of F is F composed with gamma 1, F composed with gamma 2. Right? So if you think about it for a minute, this defines a perfectly nice element in here. Okay? What is important about this map? Well, at the level of K0, if you look at K0, 5-1, this requires a little bit of familiarity with the way these maps work, I guess, but I will just tell you what happens to the class, for instance, of that first guy, Xi1. What happens to it is that it gets, here's your Psi 1 plus Psi 2. What happens to it is that it gets sent, really, to the class of Psi 1 all the way up to Psi 4. Right, what am I doing here? I'm thinking that since I have four copies of S2, over each one of those copies of S2, I have one of these Bott projections. They number them 1 through 4. So the really important feature of this connecting map, the only really essential thing about it, is that it takes this sum of line bundles, each of which had non-zero Euler class, and moreover the product of non-zero Euler class, and it sends it to exactly another such thing, right? A direct sum now of four line bundles, each of which has non-zero Euler class, and in fact, because of the structure of the cup product in cohomology for products of even spheres, this definitely has Euler class, not zero. So I'll write that down. I equals 1 to 4 of these. This is not zero. Now, on the other hand, what happens? So I told you what happens to that sort of nasty projection. What happens to the other projection? So the trivial one, well, it's a basic fact about trivial vector bundles that if you pull them back, right, if I have a trivial vector bundle here and I pull it back to a vector bundle here, the pullback is always trivial. The pullbacks of trivial bundles are always trivial. So the only thing that I need to know in order to figure out what the image of this is what is the rank of the image. And then the image must be the trivial vector bundle of that rank. And it happens to just be this. Okay. So by Villison's little lemma, not only did we have the situation we were after in comparing those two projections in our first C-star algebra, right, in comparing this and this, but in fact, when we look at their images, we can still apply Villison's lemma and conclude that, so now, by Villison's lemma, we have at K0 phi 1 applied to our original two guys minus K0 of phi 1 applied to this trivial guy, that's still not positive. Okay? So we've managed to preserve this phenomenon that something is not positive despite the fact that the trace of one is definitely strictly bigger than the trace of the other. You can still see that here, right? The trace of this is everywhere strictly bigger than this because of the ranks are strictly different. And so this is what Villison did. He kept iterating this construction. So at the next stage, what would he do? He would take M16 and he would take two copies of this space and he would perform the same construction over and over again. Now, this certainly produces an inductive limit C-star algebra in which the forward images of these guys you started with in the limit algebra have the property you want. This, you have non-positivity of this difference despite the fact that the trace of this is strictly bigger than the trace of this. However, if you just go naively ahead with this construction, you won't get a simple C-star algebra. But this is fairly easily corrected, so in some of the examples I've mentioned already, I guess, I've given you examples of inductive limits of matrix algebras over commutative spaces, and I've been throwing in little things like this in the corner, evaluating a function at some point. All right? So the fact is that you can do this also in Villison's construction. You have to be a little bit careful. You can only do it very occasionally, right? So as not to disturb your sort of order theoretic properties here. But it can be done. So you can throw in these little things in the corner once in a while and choose a sequence of points which has this sort of magical, sufficiently dense property that it returns to any open set infinitely many times. And that makes the limit algebra simple. So there's a fairly standard technique for making the limit algebra simple, which can be carried out without disturbing the phenomenon you're after. So by adding some ends of the form F I to C sub I occasionally, one can arrange for simplicity in the limit. Okay, and that essentially is Delison's construction. This is how he finds this negative answer to Blackadar's question. Okay, one thing that was particularly one thing you'll notice about the construction as I've written it is that every time I double the size of the matrices, I also double the size of the spaces. I mean, the covering dimension of the spaces roughly keeps pace with the sizes of the matrices. It's in fact true that there's no way to get the phenomenon that Villison observed in a C-star algebra that doesn't have that property. And an inductive limit where the spaces don't keep pace with the size of the matrices. So Villison's algebra was very interesting because it was the first example of an inductive limit of matrices over spaces, which could not be written as what is called a slow dimension growth C-star algebra. Okay? This is also a fairly long-standing open question, so I should point that out as well. So the relevance of that fact is that in all of the classification theorems up until that time, and indeed since then, which involve taking inductive limits of some kind of matrices over spaces, you always have to have the property that the matrix fibers are growing very rapidly compared to the covering dimensions of the underlying spaces. And Villison basically cracked the case here by showing that this essentially is going to be a necessary condition for classification. So, however, you might ask immediately, okay, if this is such a nasty C-star algebra, is it possible that you know, you can use this to get something, a pair of algebras which have the same invariant, same K-theory and traces, but are not isomorphic? And in the case of Villison's algebra here, it didn't seem possible. I mean, the K-theory, K-zero group of the C-star algebra that he built is completely intractable. I mean, you can't compute it, and so... That's right. Yeah, I mean, and that was the feeling, I guess, initially, was that this very strange order structure, and I guess the Lisset theorists in the audience will know that ordered, I mean, an ordered abelian group is far, far more complicated than just the abelian group. So the order structure could contain an enormous amount of information, and indeed the K0 group in this algebra is extremely complicated. So it wasn't clear at the time whether, you know, this was going to cause trouble for this point of view. Yeah, it turns out that you can sort of massage Villison's construction to get counterexamples, but these are, I mean, they're not so negative in that they have really pointed the way to somehow what we were missing, I think. So this... this statement doesn't... I've taken the question off, haven't I? Sorry. So they cause trouble from the point of view that you hope that this invariant classifies things, but... Well, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that eventually it turns out that there is something... At that point, one has to decide whether one is inclined to prove that it's going to work or that it isn't, and so that's... this is the one point in my career when pessimism and laziness were really useful. The truth is that it might be sufficient for some restricted classes of not so nice, of these fast dimension growth algebras. But so far we have no techniques for proving that. But, that's why we always got along so well. That's why we always got along so well. All Okay, so the thing I'm going to, I've got 15 minutes left. Now, to tell you a little bit about you know, where things are going now and what has been a very active branch of research over the past couple of years. And that is the study of an invariant for C-star algebras called the Kunsthamy group. So let me tell you what it is. It's based on the following relation introduced by Kunst in 1978, I think. Although the way I'm going to state it was really a proposition due to Michael Hedem in the early 90s. So let A be in A be positive. Right? So just positive elements of C star algebra. We will write that A is dominated by B, and, well, okay, I'm using the same squiggly notation as is used for projections. There's a good reason for that. That's because it agrees with the original Murray von Neumann equivalence on projections. So you write this, if there exists some sequence xn in the C-star algebra such that xn b xn star converges in norm to A. So what is this supposed to mean? Well, it's a fairly straightforward exercise, at least in MN of C, to prove that this only means that the rank of B is bigger than the rank of A. Okay? So that's a nice exercise to carry out. Right? So this process of sort of cutting B down is always a rank-reducing kind of operation. And anyway, that's what it happens to boil down to. And so the way I think it's profitable to think about this relation in a general C-star algebra is being some kind of abstract measure of the rank of B being bigger than the rank of A. All right? So we'll also write that A is equivalent to B if both inequalities hold and B A. Okay? So this little squiggle turns out to be an equivalence relation on positive elements in the C-star algebra, more generally on positive elements in the stabilization of A. So what Kunst did was to construct a semigroup basically in exactly the same way that we constructed the Murray von Neumann semigroup of equivalence classes of projections, except now he used all positive elements. So we will write capital W of A for what? For so remember we had this M infinity of A. What is that? That's a nested union of all the finite sized matrix algebras over A. And I'll put a plus here. So these are positive elements of M infinity of A. And you mod out by this equivalence relation. Okay, and so write, we'll use these angle brackets for the class of A. Okay, so with this semigroup, you can define a nice addition, just as you do in the Murray von Neumann semigroup. Since you have these big matrices, you can take the positive elements and you can add them orthogonally, you know, into a big matrix box. And you can also put a partial order on this using the original relation that you used to build the equivalence relation, okay? So this yields a partially ordered abelian semigroup called the Kunsthamy semigroup. And, all right, so the Kunsthamy semigroup is in general extremely complicated. For instance, if you just think about, even already, if you just think about C01, and you think of all the positive elements in C01, one thing you can prove is that two positive elements in C01 are equivalent in the same sense of Kunst, if and only if they have exactly the same support. Okay, so this relation boils down to what is the support of the positive element. That's just inside the algebra. More generally, if you look at matrices over the algebra, what you find is that the Kunst equivalence class of a positive element in a matrix over this is just determined by its rank function. Okay, but already it's clearly going to be uncountable. Even where, on the other hand, the Murray von Neumann semigroup here is just Z plus. Okay. I suppose so. It turns out that certainly in the case of commutative C-star algebras, the trace space is already enough to classify. I guess what I'm pointing out is that there's no good reason to consider the semigroup in the commutative case, because already this space of traces recovers, the whole C-star algebra, the Gelfand-Neimark theorem. So it's understandable that it wasn't paid much heed, in the early going. And if instead you have C of X, then the Kunst semigroup will pick up, amongst other things, all the non-trivial K-theory of all the closed subsets of X, not just of X globally, but of all its closed subsets. So even if X is contractible, if it's an N-cube, it has its closed subsets can have extremely complicated K-theory. And that will show up, basically, in the Kunst semigroup. So in general, if you have C of X, you can compute the trace space, I guess. It's just the extreme points are just the points of X. But if you have C of X, in general, you cannot compute. It's not feasible to compute the Kunst semigroup. You would already need to know, for instance, the ordered K-theory of arbitrary products of spheres, which is... Oh. Yeah, I suppose. I'm just proposing that it's somewhat difficult to compute. Relative to the trace space, it's more difficult to compute the Kunst semigroup. Yeah. Anyway. No, it's definitely not. No. If you have K-theory, then you have things like excision and so on. You have some hope, perhaps, of computing the K-theory of the commutative algebra, whereas general it might, it's not, I have no idea how to compute it for anything of dimension greater than one.
But it's actually known that it's different from the
Yes, yeah, I mean, that's known. In fact, it's quite different. I'll explain how it's different briefly in these last few seconds here. So, in the case of the Kunst semigroup, you can ask a question very similar to the question that Blackadar asked. So if tau is a trace on A, we define d tau of the Kunst equivalence class as follows. It should be the limit as n tends to infinity of the trace applied to A to the 1 over n. Now, it's not obvious that this doesn't depend on the representative you choose, but in the end, it doesn't. Okay, but what am I defining? Basically, this is a state on the Kunst semigroup which comes from a trace. And how should you think of this? Well, what would happen if A were just a non-negative diagonal matrix? Right? As you take the successive nth roots, all the diagonal entries converge either to 1 or to 0, depending on whether or not 1 or 0. And the normalized trace of that limit, which in fact exists in norm, then we'll just give you the normalized rank. So the way to think of these functions is that to every trace, you have a sensible way of computing the rank of the elements in the C-star algebra. Okay, so Blackadar, this is another question, and in fact, Blackadar did ask it, but it was somewhat less famous than his projection question. Suppose, again, A is unital simple with a trace. And that d tau of A strictly less than B tau of B for all tau in the trace space of A, and for some AB positive, right? So now that I can, does it follow that A is dominated by B in the sense of Kunz? Equivalently, the class of A is less equal to the class of B. Right? And in fact, if A and B are projections, then this reduces precisely to the question of Black-Hadar that Villison addressed. But it's a slightly more general thing. Now you're talking about this big Kunz semigroup, and you're asking more or less the same question. Do traces determine the order on this semigroup in some sense? And using essentially the same construction that Villison used, but some... The negative answer that Villison gave, of course, is a negative answer to this question. But you could ask, is it possible that this fails, despite the fact that the question when restricted to projections holds? Right? Could it fail in a way that's undetectable at the level of K-theory? And that is, in fact, what turns out to be the case. So if you take Villison's construction, remember we started with M4 C of, and then we had a product of spheres. Well, if in fact you replace that product of spheres with just an N cube, I guess 6 will do, and then you use exactly the same maps that I was using before, continuous functions now on 2 copies of this 6 cube, right? So nothing about the construction changes except that I change the spaces, right? The bonding maps are defined in exactly the same way. And you can see, of course, because the spaces are all contractible, the K0 group of this is straightforward to compute. It's just the 8, well, I had 8, where did I have 8? It would be like the 4 attic rationals. And the K0 group is well behaved. It's the same as the K0 group of a UHF algebra. And the K1 group vanishes because these are contractible spaces. But it turns out that this nevertheless fails in here. So Black-Hadar's original question about projections, that holds here. If the order structure on the K0 group is completely determined by traces, but the order structure on the Kunz semigroup is not determined by traces. All right. So what happens is that then what you do is you take you get a limit algebra here A, and the fact is that the invariance of A and the invariance of A tensored with some suitably chosen UHF algebra, they are the same, but the difference is that in this guy this property holds, and in this one this doesn't hold. Okay, so essentially what you can find is the Villison phenomenon can occur among positive elements in a way that is not detected at the level of projections, and that somehow is just the extra bit of information that so far we know we need. And so I guess much current research is concentrating on the Kunz semigroup. So one thing I should say before we close is that in all the cases where the original conjecture holds, the Kunz semigroup is recovered in a functorial, very nice way from Elliott's invariant. Okay, so this in a sense, this Kunz semigroup, it's not additional. It's been there all along. It's just equivalent to the K0 and traces part of the original invariant. But it just happens that it's finer once you get away from these slow dimension growth C-scales. Yes, yeah, right. Yeah. So let me close with on a positive note and state on a recent theorem of George and Aline Perka. I'm trying to help. And that is this, this Kunz semigroup is a complete invariant for limits of C-star algebras of the form direct sum 1 to n, some matrices, and then continuous functions over the interval. What's different about this from the original, I mean, this in fact is covered by this AP theorem in the simple case. Here there's no requirement that the algebras be unital or even be simple. And in fact, they need not contain any great wealth of projections or anything like that. But this just showcases the sensitivity of this Kunth semigroup. So what is really nice about this is it shows that the Kunth semigroup always classifies these, records the ideal structure, all this sort of stuff. And if you restrict to the unital simple case, it suddenly just devolves into the original invariant of K0 on traces. So it really, it's not just some ad hoc way of distinguishing two C-star algebras. It seems to be a very important part of what we were missing in the general classification problem. So let's say that this sort of brings us up to date. Thank you for your attention.